And we are seconds away for Deadline NYC with Tom Robbins. But just wanted to remind folks before we go into that program that it is you, the listener out there, that will support us and has supported us for 63 years. And just making a minor appeal right now to just say, hey, if you haven't done it yet, hey, consider doing it. The number to call to show your support is 212-209-2950, or go to give to WBAI.org online on the interwebs, you know, that mysterious cyberspace out there that exists and not exists at the same time. I don't know. It just feels all metaphysical at this point. Anyway, with that said, enough of me blabbing. Stay tuned for Deadline NYC coming up. It is 5 p.m.
Here's some advice for your friend. Don't press your luck. Lay off of me. Don't print that story.
What's that supposed to be? An order?
Listen to me! Print that story, you're a dead man!
Mark, it's not just me anymore. You'd have to stop every newspaper in the country now, and you're not big enough for that job. People like you have tried it before, with bullets, prison, censorship. But as long as even one newspaper will print the truth, you're finished.
That noise, what's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
It's a city full of fun. I say, welcome to New York, brother. It's a city full of fun. Yeah. They got plenty of rats and roaches, enough welfare for everyone.
A whole lot of police cars. There's Leon Thomas on vocals, Johnny Hodges alto sax, welcoming us to New York, or at least the New York of 1970. Before that, the unmistakable voice of Humphrey Bogart playing the tough guy newspaper editor in the 1952 film classic Deadline USA, telling the racketeer, there's no way, baby, to stop a free press. My name's Tom Robbins. I've taken that fine movie title for the name of this show, which I call Deadline NYC. Back in 2010, I sat in a courtroom in Brooklyn's federal court watching the lawyer for a man who had been convicted of murder try to persuade a judge that prosecutors had brutally railroaded his client into prison. The lawyer put one of the witnesses who had testified against his client at the original trial back on the stand. This time the witness told a very different story. He'd been strung out on crack at the time, he told the judge. He hadn't wanted to testify and didn't have any real information to offer, but he said the prosecutor had threatened to send him to jail if he refused. He was going to hit me over the head with a coffee table or something if I didn't do it, the witness told the judge. The lawyer's client had already been behind bars for 16 years. But I watched as the evidence that had sent him to prison simply melted away in that courtroom. The judge, hearing the appeal, expressed outrage at the prosecution's behavior. They had manipulated the arms of the justice system, she said. She soon vacated the conviction, sending the lawyer's client home to his family, who had been seated in the courtroom, quietly watching and waiting. It was an astonishing real-world lesson in how easily justice can be perverted by gung-ho prosecutors just eager to score a win. In the years since that hearing, I came to know the lawyer who won that appeal pretty well. His name is Joel Rudin, and he's done what he did in that courtroom many times since, helping bring people home who were wrongfully convicted. He also makes sure that the city and state pay for their misdeeds, filing civil lawsuits, helping people sent to prison for crimes they never committed win compensation. for what they endured. He's so good at what he does, this Joel Rudin. His peers in the New York State Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys gave him their Thurgood Marshall Award as Outstanding Criminal Defense Practitioner a couple of years ago. Just last week, along with lawyer Ron Kuby, who takes on the same kind of hard-to-win appeals, Mr. Rudin persuaded a judge in Brooklyn Supreme Court to reverse the convictions of two men who were convicted of a shooting on the word of a single witness, a witness who had such bad eyesight he never could have seen what he swore to in court. But his eyesight problems had been concealed at the original trial. There's a story today in thecity.nyc, the news site, about one of those people. He's still sitting in Rikers, unfortunately, waiting to go home. But welcome, Joel Rudin, to WBAI. Thanks for joining us this evening.
Sure, Tom. Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Glad to have you. So let's just walk through your back pages a little bit, Joel Rudin. You told me you were initially, when you got out of college, headed toward a career as a journalist. We would have been glad to have you in our profession, but what pulled you away into the law? How did that happen?
Well, I was an editor of my college newspaper, which had been a tremendous experience. It was during the Watergate era in the 1970s, so Woodward and Bernstein were my heroes, and I wanted to be an investigative reporter. And my first job was at a newspaper in Springfield, Massachusetts, where the sole requirement to get the job was to be able to type 50 words a minute after errors, because they wanted to eliminate the composing room and cut back their expenses in producing the newspaper.
Right.
But I like to think I had more qualifications than that, and they assigned me to cover courts totally by accident. They had no idea if I had any aptitude for it. And I started to cover courts, and I sort of fell into a story that I thought was a really good investigative piece that I thought we had very strong evidence to show that federal drug enforcement agents had framed a bail bondsman in Hartford, Connecticut, charged him with involvement in an organized crime-related drug conspiracy they couldn't possibly have committed because he was in Hartford when he was supposed to have been in Springfield. And I came to New York. I interviewed his attorney, who happened to be Henry Rothblatt, who was one of the Watergate defense attorneys, which was very, very exciting. And I produced the story. And they wouldn't use it. They wouldn't use a story that would shake things up in Springfield, that would be controversial. And eventually I grew frustrated, and I decided to apply to law school because I wanted to get the background so that I could get a better job in journalism.
Uh-huh.
And so I went to NYU Law School, and after my first year of law school, I sort of had to decide whether to work that summer in a law-related job or whether to go back and work for a newspaper. And I decided on the law-related job, and that sort of became my path through life. I never went back to journalism, although from time to time I fantasized about it.
Well, that was a pretty rude awakening in the journalism business. I can't blame you for deciding that maybe there's an easier way to make a living. That sounds like a great story. And it also sounds like, unfortunately, not uncommon response from editors who are worried about shaking up the local poobahs sometimes. So you eventually became a defense attorney, Joel Rudin, and at some point, was there a moment or a case that made you decide to specialize in wrongful convictions, or were you already doing that?
Well, I viewed myself as a dedicated criminal defense lawyer. I considered my mission to represent anybody who either could afford to retain my firm. I worked for a private firm for a few years, and then sort of in a crazy move, I hung my shingle and went out on my own after having done just one trial, which was a bit nuts. But anyway, I would represent anyone who could afford to retain our firm, or I got on the court-appointed list, what's called the 18B panel, and was appointed clients in the state court system, and later on got on the Criminal Justice Act panel. So I was appointed clients in the federal system, and both did trial work and appellate work. And when you do an appeal, you're trying to show that your client was wrongfully convicted, usually because either there was insufficient evidence or there was something unfair about the process. And I did this for many years. And then in the late 1980s, I got involved in a series of cases in the Bronx called the Procca Daycare Center cases, where the Bronx District Attorney at the time, Mario Merola, had joined the national bandwagon to go after people who allegedly had been involved in sexually abusing children at daycare centers. There had not been any reports of that happening before the early 1980s, and after the mid-1980s, there weren't that many reports of it ever happening again.
Right.
But during the mid-1980s, there were this rash of cases all over the country, and I represented a number of people who had been convicted and was able to get their cases reversed. And one of them was a case where a man spent 7 years in prison for allegedly raping a six-year-old girl. Mm. It turned out there was an incredible amount of evidence that he was innocent and that the story had been made up by the girl under pressure from her mother. And so that was a case that a motion that I brought after he'd already lost his appeal to try to overturn the conviction based on that new evidence, and was successful. So that was one of the first cases I did that I guess would be called a wrongful conviction case. But in my view, any case where someone is convicted in an unfair way is a wrongful conviction case.
In that daycare case, it sounds like it gave you pretty good insight into what could happen in a prosecutor's office where they were bent on making a case, even make the facts fit the crime, even if the crime's not there. Did you begin to sort of make connections you hadn't made before at that point?
Well, I had seen through my first 10 or so years of practice that I would learn about the possible existence of favorable evidence to the defense known as Brady material, which the U.S. Supreme Court in 1963 held had to be disclosed to the defense so that it would have a fair opportunity or have a fair trial. And I had seen in many cases that I would make motions to the judge to order the prosecution to turn over such evidence, and the motions would be routinely denied. So it was a frustration that the rule wasn't being enforced, and this is a rule that's designed to really to ensure that innocent people don't get convicted, mm-hmm. so that the defense has access to the evidence to show that someone may be innocent or that the witnesses against him may be so incredible that essentially there's no case. So I was aware of that being a problem, but the Ramos case was a real eye-opener because the amount of evidence that exonerated him and destroyed the credibility of the only witness was just enormous. Yeah. And somehow a very experienced prosecutor in the Bronx DA's office managed to withhold all of it.
Withholding evidence. That, now, in the case that you and Ron Kuby just won in Brooklyn Supreme Court, the defense was kind of, I don't know, I guess blindsided is a bad term because given the circumstances, but back when that case was tried, they found out at the last minute who the witnesses against their client was going to be and didn't really have time to find out the fact that this guy really probably couldn't have seen what he claimed to have seen, and he was the sole eyewitness. Is that right?
Right. Yeah, well, the sole eyewitness was not identified until the day before the trial began.
It's kind of prosecution by ambush, right?
Yes, the prosecution not only withheld the identity of the witness, which judges tended to allow prosecutors to do, particularly in violent crime cases where the prosecutors would express a concern that a witness might be harmed before testifying, and every now and then that was a concern, but it certainly wasn't a concern in every case. And then put the witness on as its first witness. So they disclosed the identity at the very end, and then they structured the trial so that that witness testifies first, which wasn't necessary, so that the defense had absolutely no time to investigate him.
Uh-huh.
During the cross-examination, one of the defense lawyers just asked a question out of left field, having no information. Do you wear glasses? And he said, well, yes, I wear glasses, but only for reading. I don't wear glasses for anything else. And they didn't have any evidence to challenge that, so that's sort of the way the case went to the jury. And the prosecutor argued that it was absurd to think that this guy had any trouble with his eyesight and argued to the jury that he was 100% sure of his identification and that they should convict, and they did. And my client served 22 years in prison before he was released on parole, and Ron Kuby's client is hopefully about to be released, but has served more than 23 years in prison. And then it turned out that when I took the case many years later and reinvestigated it, it turned out that the witness's ex-wife, who had been unwilling to cooperate with the defense at the time of trial because the victim of the shooting was a good friend of hers and she was being supportive of her boyfriend, later husband, by this time, years later, she was divorced, and when she learned that the defendants had been convicted based solely on her former husband's testimony and that he had testified that he only used glasses for reading, she was pretty outraged, and she agreed to cooperate with us and provided us with photographs showing him wearing glasses, and we obtained his, she had his eyeglass prescription records, which showed that he needed glasses and his eyesight was severely impaired. And then it turned out that, of all things, the conviction review unit of the Brooklyn DA's office, I'm sad to report, when we were demanding access to his eyeglass records, they had obtained his motor vehicle records, which showed that he failed an eyesight test, and he needed glasses to drive. He was required to wear glasses to drive, which meant that his vision at best was 20/50, and it could have been worse. And they didn't disclose those records, and we didn't get them until the court ordered a hearing.
Huh. All right. Well, conviction review, you know. I'll come back to that in a little bit to talk about what they are and whether or not they're working. This is WBAI 99.5 FM. The show's called Deadline NYC. My name's Tom Robbins. I'm talking to Joel Rudin, who is a veteran defense attorney specializing in wrongful conviction cases, and who is just, as he was just talking about with Ron Kuby, brought home at least one of the two guys who were wrongfully convicted 20-something years ago here in Brooklyn. Joel, one of the things that you did, I think, in the Bronx case, and I think you probably have followed it up since, is that you started digging into whether or not prosecutors who had hidden evidence or done things where they'd been sort of slapped down by the judges or by appeals panels for hiding evidence or doing other misdeeds, to find out whether or not any of them had ever been disciplined by their office, in the district attorney's office. I think in the Bronx case you found 70 prosecutors who had committed misconduct, but nothing happened to them. Do I have that right?
Yes.
And that was kind of par for the course in DA's office, you found, as you kept going along that line of questioning.
You know, this is one of the gratifications of being a lawyer as opposed to a journalist.
Right.
Because as a lawyer, I had subpoena power, and I also, as a lawyer, I also had the ability during a civil lawsuit to compel the other side to provide discovery. And so in the late 1990s, when I brought a civil lawsuit for Alberto Ramos, having, after his conviction was overturned, to try to recover monetary damages for him, he had an awful time in prison, and just unspeakable things happened to him, and he certainly deserved substantial compensation. But the problem was that prosecutors cannot be sued individually. They have what's called absolute immunity. The Supreme Court decided quite a while ago that prosecutors should not be allowed to be sued so that they could make judgments in the handling of criminal cases without fear of personal liability. So that is an understandable rationale, but it also comes with a cost. And the cost is that prosecutors know that no matter what they do, they're immune from being sued. So the problem we had in the Alberto Ramos case was to figure out how to try to recover for him compensation, even though we couldn't sue the prosecutor who was responsible. And it happened that right around that time, the Federal Court of Appeals in New York handed down a decision which basically held that you could sue the city of New York for the unlawful policies of a district attorney, because a district attorney is essentially a city official, mm-hmm. even though he prosecutes cases on behalf of the state of New York. And so if you could show that an individual prosecutor's misconduct in a particular case was caused by an unlawful policy of the district attorney, who is essentially the boss of the prosecutor, then you could hold New York City responsible for the damage, even though you could not hold the individual prosecutor responsible.
And what happened once you used your subpoena power to start digging out those records, Joel Rudin?
Yeah, so then what we found, we did a search, and we came up with 72 cases decided by various courts involving Bronx prosecutions, which found misconduct by Bronx prosecutors, many of them involved withholding favorable evidence from the defense. A lot of them involved deliberately presenting false and misleading testimony or making false and misleading argument to the jury or other kinds of misconduct during summation. And so I made we made a demand for the discipline, for the personnel records, excuse me, the personnel records of the 72 prosecutors, and we found out that out of those 72 prosecutors, only one had been disciplined, and that particular prosecutor had been implicated in four or five really, really bad cases. Yeah. And in a very unusual situation, the disciplinary committee of the First Judicial Department, which is the court's the arm of the court that disciplines attorneys, had written to the Bronx DA's office and indicated that they wanted some records because they were going to start an investigation. And the district attorney wrote to them and said, don't worry about it, I've taken care of it. And in fact, he docked the prosecutor, I think it was 2 weeks' pay.
That was it.
And shortly afterwards, restored the lost pay and gave him a bonus and a raise.
So much for that. All right.
And that was the full extent of the discipline over many, many years under Mario Merola as the Bronx DA, and then his successor, Robert Johnson.
Amazing. And so this technique that you helped devise here in terms of figuring out kind of an end run around the fact that you can't sue the prosecutor himself, but you can come up with a way to go after the office. You followed that same route in at least two other boroughs, am I right, in Brooklyn and in Queens. You did it in the case I opened up talking about, right, when you sued on behalf of Jabbar Collins, the man I was describing who was won that appeal in federal court. And you dug deeply into then Joe Hines's office in Brooklyn and found a similar pattern.
Yeah, well, don't leave out Manhattan. I've also done it with Manhattan.
Okay. Equal opportunity, Manhattan, too, right?
they were no better, although there weren't as many reported cases of Brady violations or withholding of evidence involving the Manhattan DA, which could very well be because that office had this aura about it that they could do no wrong, and a lot of the judges would defer to them, but I don't think Brooklyn or Queens or the Bronx had quite the same reputation among judges. But in any event, yes, in Brooklyn, Jabbar Collins, it was the exact same situation. The prosecutor in that case, Michael Vecchione, had, based on the evidence we developed, had failed to disclose an incredible amount of evidence that impeached all of the or contradicted all of the prosecution's witnesses, including the fact that the main witness had recanted, and other witnesses had been coerced. And then when we filed a motion to overturn the conviction, he submitted an affidavit which denied that any of these violations had occurred. All the documents that we later are uncovered certainly proved to the contrary. And so we brought a lawsuit. We actually named him individually and some other prosecutors individually for their roles, not as the prosecutors in the case, but in their role as Freedom of Information Law officers. That later on, Jabbar Collins brought Freedom of Information Law lawsuits to try to uncover documents in this case, and the office continually swore that the documents didn't exist, and eventually we found that many of them did exist, so we sued. But the judge in that case in federal court dismissed and said that absolute immunity protected them for that as well.
And had there been any disciplinary taken against people who'd been sanctioned by court findings in the Brooklyn District Attorney's office?
Not that I'm aware of.
Let's just pause for a second and talk about Jabbar Collins, because he is such a remarkable person and a remarkable case. You mentioned that he had done his own Freedom of Information request, and that's while he was in prison, right?
Yeah, I mean, Jabbar was really remarkable. He became a jailhouse lawyer at Greenhaven Correctional Facility, and he spent years not only helping other inmates, some of whom were actually released based on his legal work, but he spent years in reinvestigating his own case. And one of the witnesses against him had been made a secret deal by the Brooklyn DA's office, but that had not been revealed at his trial. And I mean, Jabbar didn't. All he knew was that there must be some reason why these witnesses lied against me, but he didn't know why. So that particular witness, he called up, making a three-way call from prison, and he posed as an investigator for the Brooklyn DA's office, trying to reconstruct their file following 9/11.
Yeah.
their records had been destroyed, and he was trying to find out what had happened. And he interviewed the witness, and the witness disclosed that Michael Vecchione, the prosecutor, together with a couple of other people from the Brooklyn DA's office, had flown down to Puerto Rico, where he had absconded in violation of his probation. And they promised him that they would take care of his probation violation if he came back to New York and testified. And so he came back to New York and testified. That was never disclosed. Later on, we got the documents that showed that it had happened. And so then when we brought a motion to vacate the conviction in state court, the judge, well, the DA's office and then the judge, were feigned outrage that Jabbar Collins had posed as an investigator from the DA's right. office, which was technically right. a misdemeanor,
right.
even though he did it in a way calculated to get the truth. But they had absolutely no problem with the fact that he had been railroaded and sent to prison for 25 years to life
right.
when the Brooklyn DA's office withheld the truth.
Yeah.
But finally, a federal judge got to the bottom of it and overturned the conviction.
Yeah. An amazing case. I remember reading that decision by the Brooklyn state judge in which he said that Jabbar Collins' appeal was built on a foundation of fraud, meaning the very
right.
clever guys that you just described, which was finding a way for him to be able to get at the truth of how he had been railroaded into prison. It does take a certain amount of guile in order to be able to crack past that. Well, you do have subpoena power, but that doesn't always give you all the information you're after. You pursued the case on behalf of Jabbar Collins, and Joe Hines put up an awful lot of obstacles in your way. I remember he had this thing where he was giving witnesses special treatment. What do they call it? Hotel Hines?
Hotel Hines, the Hotel Custody Program.
Yeah.
I had actually had a case in the 1990s where I learned about it, but then it turned out they had all sorts of records that were not part of the case files, and they would never turn them over. That's where the Freedom of Information Law came in, where they would certify that they had turned over all the records in the office, but it turned out they would only search in the prosecution file. So they had witness protection or witness relocation files where they would pay thousands of dollars to witnesses and make promises to witnesses. They had hotel custody records where they kept track of witnesses who had been basically arrested and put in hotels and guarded and kept incommunicado, sometimes for over weeks, without any access to the courts or to attorneys or even to their families until they testified favorably for the DA. And so there was the witness in Jabbar's case, who you mentioned at the opening of the show, was actually picked up by the DA's office and held in a jail for 1 week. And then they got custody of him, and they held him at a hotel for another week.
Oh, right.
All
he said it was paradise compared to the jail, right.
Right. That's true. All until he agreed to testify favorably for them and basically testified falsely.
Right.
So it turned out that we were able through the – this is why I say that lawyers have certain access to court process that journalists don't have. We were able in the discovery process in Jabbar's case to get access to their hotel custody logbooks and the individual files in about 40 or 50 cases, which showed the number of cases where they were holding people often against their will in secret. And in many of those cases, not disclosing that to the defense. So, I mean, imagine one side to a legal battle in court has the power to jail a witness
right.
until the witness agrees to testify favorably for that side
right.
and otherwise hold the witness indefinitely. I mean,
right.
what an awesome power and what an awesome risk of false testimony to convict people and put them away for many years.
Exactly. Let's just tie up the Jabbar Collins story. Tell folks what Jabbar Collins is doing today.
Well, he won a very nice recovery in his lawsuits, and then he's now running a consulting service for others, for both lawyers and inmates who have been wrongfully convicted, and has an expertise that equals some of the finest lawyers in that field, and is providing that expertise to clients who retain the services.
It's a pretty remarkable story. All right, we're going to take a short music break here just for a couple of minutes. When we come back, I want to revisit that conviction review unit that we mentioned a moment ago. But hold on. This is WBAI 99.5 FM. The show is Deadline NYC. My name's Tom Robbins, and I'm talking to Joel Rudin, veteran criminal defense lawyer. Hammers ring. That was Bessie Smith, from little scratchy, but 1924, still one of the greatest voices ever. They're gonna journey up the Hudson, going on a lonesome trail. They can put me in the death house or keep me in Sing Sing jail. You know, she didn't come from this part of the country, but she sure knew about Sing Sing prison, didn't she? Joel Rudin, we were talking about the fact that the Brooklyn unit that has been created to review possibly wrongful convictions failed to provide you with records in this latest case regarding a witness and his eyesight problems. Let's just back up for a second. And I think every DA in New York City of the five, I think everybody's got a wrongful conviction unit except Staten Island, or maybe they've added one too. Do you have any idea?
Yeah, I don't know. I've dealt with the other four, but not Staten Island.
Yeah, so they all have, and Brooklyn was the first. Joe Hines, when you were pushing him up against the wall in your cases and other cases of wrongful convictions began to emerge, he sort of created his own kind of version of one. But then he lost re-election to Ken Thompson, and Ken Thompson came in and created a conviction review unit, which, you know, I think in fairly short order had exonerated about two dozen people. But that's fallen off recently. Is that right?
Yeah, well, Hines created one that sort of illustrates the dangers of them. He was beginning to create one anyway, and there were some emails between him and some other individuals that came out, both in the Collins case and in another place, where it was pretty clear that he was trying to put friends of his on some sort of review unit to offer him cover. And it would not have been a true conviction review unit, at least not one with integrity.
Well, what would a true one do, Joel Rudin?
Well, a true one, and I'm not saying the Brooklyn one isn't. I think the Brooklyn one is right now, but I think they lost steam for a while. But they're regaining it. But a true one will independently review an old conviction. And when I say independently, I mean independent of the prosecutor who obtained it, whose conduct may be coming under scrutiny, who will be willing to reinvestigate the case with an eye towards determining either that the defendant quite likely is innocent or they've lost confidence in the guilty verdict, or that the process was so unfair that they can't really rely on the integrity of the guilty verdict, and then will be willing to act on it. And ultimately, it comes down to the district attorney, who's the elected official who has responsibility for a particular district attorney's office. And so a conviction review unit that's used by a district attorney as a way to avoid doing anything, or as a way to maybe neutralize a potential defense case by interviewing all the witnesses and trying to discredit them rather than in good faith trying to see if they're telling the truth and the conviction should be overturned. I mean, that kind of conviction review unit can be dangerous to justice. But in New York, fortunately, I think right now, and again, I don't know about Staten Island, but I think we have, for the most part, very good conviction review units who are run by people who really are well-meaning. And so far, of course, lawyers in individual cases may disagree with the outcome, and I've certainly disagreed with the failure of the Brooklyn DA's office to do anything in my present case that you've been talking about. But for the most part, they seem to be trying to do the right thing. And district attorneys have, at least in the most clear-cut cases, followed through and done the right thing.
So that's a major step forward from when you began doing this kind of work of pressing wrongful convictions in court and having to fight it all the way yourself. Let me just let people know that, I mean, it's up ultimately to the district attorney themselves to be able to make the decision. The people who are reviewing these cases are not the assistant district attorneys, presumably, who worked on the original conviction, but they're in the office, right? They're not independent people from outside.
Right. If people have been hired to be part of a unit that is supposed to be independent of the rest of the office. Interesting, under District Attorney Vance in Manhattan, his conviction integrity unit for quite a while would assign the original prosecutor to work on the reinvestigation, which I think is quite problematic. And it's probably no accident that very few cases came out of that integrity unit. Very few were overturned.
Well, you know, I was going to ask you, maybe this is the right time to do it. You wrote a whole article about probably the two most significant exonerations that former Manhattan District Attorney Cy Vance did shortly before he left office. And that was, even though it was many, many years after the fact, the exoneration of the two men convicted of killing Malcolm X more than 60 years before. As you say, Vance had been reluctant to pursue these cases, but he seemed to step up when that finally was done. He apologized to the surviving defendant. The other person, I think, had passed away. But you wrote an article about it, Joel Rudin. One of the things that was so remarkable about the case is that there were a total of 14 eyewitnesses who had sworn they saw these two men shoot Malcolm X before an audience of some 400 people. How does that happen?
Right.
And they got it wrong. How does that happen?
Yeah, well, I think Cy Vance did the right thing in that case, and he was he's to be commended for the investigation that he did and for the outcome. But the question I raised in my article is how could it be that in the Malcolm X case there were so many eyewitnesses who swore that these two defendants committed the crime? What does that say about all the other people who are in prison on one or two or three eyewitness accounts? How can it happen with 14? Well, it happens back then in the mid-1960s. Some of the Supreme Court decisions that later came down to protect the rights of criminal defendants either hadn't come down yet or they really weren't being enforced. They're not always enforced now, but they certainly are a lot more now than then. And so eyewitness identifications were conducted in a very unfair way, showing a single photograph to a witness or showing a single suspect to a witness or showing a lineup where most of the fillers look nothing like the witness, or saying, why don't you take a look at number three, when number three is the suspect, and keeping no record of that so that the defense would never find out it happened. All sorts of ways to try to influence the result. I have no idea what happened in the Malcolm X case, but certainly the willingness of Cy Vance to overturn a conviction where there were so many eyewitness identifications was a profound statement about how wrong eyewitness identification evidence can be. And it, to me, raises so many questions about so many other cases that are not being reexamined.
Well, talk for a minute about misidentification, Joel Rudin. I mean, so many of the exonerations, whether they're for withheld evidence or for DNA evidence, include someone who is a witness who has misidentified the person who is convicted.
I'm sorry, what was the question?
Well, in the Malcolm X case, seven people testified in court that they had seen those two people kill Malcolm X. Seven other people were not presented as witnesses, but they told the police the exact same thing. And you sort of go back and take a look at sort of survey the incidence of misidentification in exoneration cases. And it seems like misidentification is one of the most common chords in all these cases. How do people get it so wrong?
Well, I think that one of the incredible accomplishments of the Innocence Project, and Barashek and Peter Neufeld really worked a revolution in criminal justice in this country, is that you have several hundred cases where people have been proven through DNA evidence to be clearly innocent. And so you can take their cases as test cases. You can try to then go back and try to figure out what went wrong. I mean, most of the cases I've handled have not been DNA cases. They've been cases where I've tried to establish that something went wrong and the procedure that was used was unfair or evidence was withheld. But it's difficult in those cases to prove to anyone conclusively that my client is innocent. I try to do the best I can to get the judge to think that that's either the case or likely the case, and that could certainly help bring about the desired effect. But in the DNA cases, we know for sure in most of these cases that the person's innocent. And so then there have been studies made of those cases to try to figure out what the cause was of the wrongful conviction, since we know the convictions were clearly wrongful. And in a very high percentage of the cases, it's been eyewitness misidentifications.
Right.
And we know they're misidentifications because we know the person who was identified is innocent.
Right.
So, you know, then you can try to go back and try to figure out why was the person misidentified, and there have been studies of that. But a lot of times there's nothing, you can't really show anything concrete about why the person was misidentified. Sometimes it may be as simple as the detective who conducted the identification procedure knew who the suspect was and did something perhaps unconsciously to influence the witness, maybe by staring at one particular person in a lineup so that the witness sees the detective staring at that person and assumes that's the person. Or sometimes it could be something the detective does consciously. We don't know. But the problem in these non-DNA cases is that it's impossible to reconstruct what happened. The lineups have traditionally not been videotaped. They've been photographed often with very primitive Polaroid photographs where you can barely see the appearance of the individuals later on. And so the problem we had in the case we've been discussing today, the Brooklyn case, is that there was a single witness identification of my client. His appearance was totally different than the description given by the suspect.
Right.
But we had no way, until we found his ex-wife, the witness's ex-wife, to show that there was anything unfair about the process. The courts had already upheld the conviction.
It's a much
steeper... So this person, even though...
Go ahead.
Even though there was tremendous reason to doubt that this was an accurate result, and judges had actually said they had questions about it, nobody was willing to overturn it because the jury had returned a verdict of guilty and we couldn't prove what the detective did wrong. And then this new evidence came available and totally changed the situation.
It's such a much steeper hill to climb when you're lacking the DNA evidence and you're basing it on either evidence that was not available or misidentification or some other thing that you're introducing to try to persuade judges or a conviction review unit that your client is actually innocent of the crime of which he was convicted. And yet those are the cases you choose.
Yeah, those are the cases I've had.
Uh-huh.
It's until the Innocence Project developed a history of showing that this misconduct does occur and that innocent people are convicted, there are a lot of people in the criminal justice system who believe that almost never happened. The public basically didn't believe it happened. And so it was very difficult for the first part of my career as I started doing these cases to convince courts to do anything. Fortunately, the movement has gained steam, and now there are many, many lawyers who are doing what I've been doing, and there are even some lawyers bringing lawsuits against the city for misconduct by DA's offices the way I've been doing. There are a lot of large law firms who take on these cases pro bono.
Uh-huh.
Because they're looking to give experience to their associates and because they want to do the right thing.
Uh-huh.
And of course, the conviction review units are, in cases that they think have real potential, they really investigate them very well.
So do you think all these advances, Joel Rudin, have sort of balanced things out, or do you think there's still a lot of people, you know, moldering away in behind bars who actually are innocent of what they were sent away for?
I think there are a lot of people who are languishing behind bars who are innocent. I mean, there's no way to give a percentage, but I was saying, the client that I with Ron Kuby, the two clients we just succeeded in overturning their convictions, but for the fact that we found the ex-wife who was willing to come forward, there would have been probably no way to overturn their conviction. And we had gone to the conviction review unit, and they didn't really do anything in that case. So there are many people like that. There are people who write to lawyers, but they don't really know how to. They're not able to write clearly, and they don't really express themselves that clearly. They're not able to articulate what's wrong with their case, and so I mean, I get several hundred letters a year, and I try to figure out which ones to follow up. And unfortunately, the people who maybe are the least well educated and less expressive are not able to convey the injustice of their case as well as certain other people.
How do you decide?
Well, I try to figure out if there's indicia of wrongful conviction in the case. The case I've been talking about, he wrote to me in 2015, and when I saw that it was a single eyewitness, a description that didn't fit, they had a description of the automobile that didn't match, and the detective had a list of 200 automobiles that fit the description, and he arbitrarily selected this one because a relative of my client was someone the police were looking for in some unrelated case. So they went after members of the family and just made the case fit. So there's obviously something wrong with it. I just didn't know exactly what it would be. So that was a case I took on pro bono in the hope that we'd find something. But a lot of other cases I'm looking for something that I can focus on as a potential way to attack the conviction. And then if I take the case, I read all the, I mean, it takes hundreds of hours of work. My office will read all the documents in the case, the trial transcript, the appeals, the prior motions that were made, all the discovery material. We'll interview witnesses, make freedom of information law requests to try to get new documents from the government and see what comes up.
Right. But, and you go and meet with people in behind bars to get a sense of them, your clients?
So it might start with several telephone calls. It starts with a letter, then maybe a few phone calls, then it's a meeting behind bars. And it's a gradual process. If the case seems like it's worth really digging into, then we'll dig into it. But for every case we take, we probably turn down another 50 or 100.
Ouch. A lot of people looking for help out there. This is WBAI 99.5 FM. One more time. This is Deadline NYC. My name's Tom Robbins. I'm talking to veteran defense attorney Joel Rudin, who has done such great work on wrongful convictions. Joel, you have a case up in Buffalo that you're working on that sounds like you've really got your work cut out for you. You want to tell us about that one briefly?
Well, it's they call it the Buffalo Five. It's there were 5 16-year-old kids back in 1976 who there was a murder that was committed across the street from a bar, and the police eventually fixed on this group of kids, 16-year-old black kids, and several of whom lived in a nearby housing project as someone they could try to pin the case on, and they brought them all in to be interviewed, and they all told exactly the same story, that they had been partying that night at the local housing project, and then they all went home. Two of them went home in a taxi cab, and the detectives investigated, and they found the taxi cab company completely corroborated the story that the cab had picked two of them up at exactly the time that all five of them said. But then they buried that evidence, and then they went to each of them individually and try to coerce them into accusing the others. And they got one 16-year-old kid, after threatening to put him away for the rest of his life and telling him falsely that he was being implicated by his friends, they got him to accuse his four other friends of having been involved in the crime. And they actually did that by arranging a false phone call by someone who was posing as an anonymous witness, and letting him listen to the call, and that caller accused him of having committed the crime, named the other four, and in that fashion they terrorized him. They even reported in a report that he couldn't even hold his cup of coffee anymore. He was so nervous. They terrorized him into accusing the other four. So the other four went to trial. The fifth one testified against each one of them. Three were convicted. Two of them are now our clients. And Wilmer Hale, the international law firm, excellent firm, is doing the case with us pro bono. So the three were convicted. One died in, shortly after getting out of prison. The other two are our clients. And the fourth guy was acquitted the very last trial when his excellent defense lawyer made a specific demand for certain evidence, including any photographs of the crime scene showing the possibility that someone else had committed the crime. And it turned out that there was a photograph that showed a set of footprints leading from the backyard in the snow, from the backyard of the person who was killed two doors down to the house of another individual who many other witnesses had suspected of having committed the crime. And they never disclosed that photograph until the final trial. And that person was acquitted based on that photograph.
I see.
So many years later, the two surviving defendants brought a motion in state Supreme Court in Buffalo to overturn their conviction, and it was overturned, and now we're handling a lawsuit to try to obtain monetary damages for them.
And what's your sense of the way Buffalo District Attorney's Office, I mean, what you're describing by the police practice sounds pretty similar to what you've run into in New York City. Are there differences up there in terms of, are they any better at handling these cases?
I think they're a lot worse. Another case, well, I mean, in this case, they had the opportunity to do something through their through a voluntary review, and they didn't do anything.
Do they have a conviction review unit of their own that looked at this?
They have a conviction review unit, and as I understand it, in another case where the head or number two, I think it was the head of that unit, recommended that a conviction be overturned, the district attorney overturned his recommendation, and he was eventually forced out of the office.
Uh-huh.
That case is pending in court. So unfortunately, Buffalo seems to have a pretty begrudging attitude towards conviction review. The police reports from this case going back to the 1970s are really disturbing, very racially charged. I mean, the racism in the police department back then is quite obvious.
Is that different from what you've seen here in Brooklyn or Queens or the Bronx? Or?
I haven't seen anything here that's been as obvious written down in police reports back there. They don't seem to have been conscious of what they were saying. I guess there must have been an attitude that was so ingrained that they weren't conscious that they were revealing anything. New York, although this was the 1970s, I haven't really seen that many cases involving police reports from the 1970s. Maybe it was the same, but I tend to doubt it. I think Buffalo was a pretty rough place back then and pretty similar to what I assume to have been the Deep South, even though it was
the far north and the Deep South.
Far north.
All right. Okay. We've only got about a minute left here with Joel Rudin, veteran defense attorney. Joel, from what we're talking about, it does sound like things have improved somewhat for people who at least are seeking to prove their innocence. There are conviction review units. There are new rules in terms of when prosecutors are supposed to turn over evidence. Do you feel like the scales are a little more in balance than they were?
Yeah, for the few defendants who now go to trial, there's so few trials. For the few defendants who go to – well, no, actually, that's not fair. The New York discovery rules have been broadened substantially, and now there's discovery early in the case so that criminal defendants are in a much better position to evaluate the evidence and to decide what to do. And that's hugely important because in virtually all the cases that I've been involved with over the years, the wrongful conviction cases, the root cause of the unfair conviction has been the failure of the prosecution to disclose evidence to the defense would have disclosed a little bit of evidence at the very last minute. The fact that, the discovery laws have been reformed the way they have is hugely important in making the system more fair. And I hope that in the alarm that some people have shown around somewhat rising crime rates, that those reforms are not abandoned, because they really have made the system a lot more fair.
All right. We're talking to Joel Rudin, veteran defense attorney who's done so many wrongful conviction cases and laid it out in several lengthy law review articles about how district attorney's offices had failed to discipline their own DAs who had broken the rules. Joel, thanks so much for taking the time this evening. It's been great talking to you.
Likewise. Thank you, Tom.
Okay. We'll let Ace Engineer Reggie Johnson take us on out with Eddie Lockjaw Davis's Stolen Moments. Take care, everyone.
Do you think this war will ever end?
I don't know. They'll just have another one.
I want to get out of here. Don't you?
Not that much.
So you like it here?
It's not that bad.
You're in a foxhole with a war raging outside.
I know. That's why I'm sure glad I've got my WBAI.
Be glad you've got your WBAI. Become a member online at WBAI.org. Now, do it now.
We're raising money today for the Tower Fund here at WBAI.
And without that tower, we can't stay on the air.
Please, just give what you can.
And those contributions can be small or they can be large. But those are the contributions that we need to make in order to beat back the other side. No one is going to do it for us.
Even a few dollars a month helps to keep us on the air.
Let's face it. Without Pacifica, what do you have? NPR is too milquetoast. PBS, too milquetoast. Without Pacifica, we're dead in the water.
And that pledge line is 212-209-2950. 212-209-2950.
And we're only asking those who can give it, those who can afford it. We know that there's some people out there who cannot afford it, and that's one of the problems. Those of us who relatively have must stand up for those who have not.
I'm sick and tired hearing people complain about, well, you know, the right wing has Fox News and they have this and they have that. The oppressor always has more money than the oppressed. We have to make use of the resources that we have. We have people, and we have people that can make contributions.
Here on WBAI 99.5 FM, we want to have the Tower Fund strong and healthy, so we're not worried about it.
212-209-2950. Or you can go online at WBAI.org and donate to the Tower Fund.
The previous program was Deadline NYC with Tom Robbins, heard Mondays, starting at 5 p.m. here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned for the evening edition of Democracy Now!, followed by Counterspin. But before we go there, just wanted to remind you again, we need your help financially so we can continue on doing what we've been doing for 63 years.